Hi, my name is Lynn Van Valen, and this is KHOI, Door City, Ames, and surrounding areas.
Support for KHOI comes from the Ames Community Arts Council, presenting the Ames Artists Studio Tour, Saturday and Sunday, October 1st and 2nd. Artists will open their studios for tours and hands-on demonstrations. Details at amesart.org.
Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, places, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Thank you for listening. I am Mike Metz, your host, sitting in for Patchler Malm this morning. And station manager Mike Murphy is keeping that warm glow on the KHOI's vacuum tubes with his engineering prowess. Today, we will see a mostly sunny sky with a high of 72 degrees. The winds will be from the south-southeast at about 10 to 15 miles per hour. And this evening, we'll see a few more clouds moving in as temperatures drop down to around 46 degrees. The east-southeasterly winds will decrease to about 5 to 10 miles per hour. The weekend forecast calls for temperatures in the low 70s with mostly sunny skies. Sunset tonight is at 6:57 p.m. and currently it is 44 degrees. And ach du liebe, it's the last day of September, so we're going to welcome October. But meanwhile, let's welcome Dennis Hart with a summary of local news from the pages of our local newspaper.
Concerns about a building's safety on Main Street in Ames. The City Council takes the first steps toward renaming the Ames Airport. And the governor pushes to reinstate the fetal heartbeat abortion law in Iowa. All part of what made news in the Ames Tribune this past week. Let's start with last Friday's paper, which reported that the death toll in the state from the coronavirus since the pandemic began 2.5 years ago had exceeded 10,000. The state health department reported 57 new deaths, bringing the total death toll so far to 10,051. More people have died this year from the coronavirus in Iowa than did during the same period last year. In addition, 2,908 new cases of the virus were reported in Iowa. That was about 30% fewer cases than the week before. And 219 people suffering from the virus were in a hospital, compared to 232 the week before in Iowa. There was also a report that state Republicans had called on Democratic U.S. Senate candidate Mike Franken to release a former campaign staff member who has accused him of kissing her without her permission from a non-disclosure agreement. Franken's campaign manager said no such NDA exists, and Franken denies anything happened. Kimberly Strope Bogus, who had worked on Franken's campaigns both this year and in 2022, had filed a report in April with the Des Moines Police Department alleging that Franken had kissed her on the mouth without permission. The police report indicates the incident allegedly took place in March, about 1 month after Strope Bogus and another staffer were fired. Franken allegedly met with Strope Bogus to discuss the possibility of her returning to the campaign. She told police Franken grabbed the collar of her vest and kissed her on the mouth after the two had drinks. Police investigated and found there was insufficient information and evidence to pursue a criminal complaint. Republican incumbent U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley said voters deserve clear answers about the allegations against Franken. The Trib also reported that Iowa Republican Governor Kim Reynolds and her Democratic Party opponent Deidre DeGeer are scheduled to appear together in one debate in October. It will take place on Monday, October 17th, and will be televised by Iowa PBS. And there was word about a new website to help Iowans who are battling an opioid use disorder. The website is iowaopioid-help.com. It has a list of providers contracted with the state who can offer treatment options for opioid use disorder. Saturday's Trib reported that the second of two women charged with sabotaging the Dakota Access Pipeline was sentenced to 6 years in prison after the judge found that her actions constituted a crime of terrorism. Ruby Montoya, who lived in Des Moines at the time, was charged with multiple acts of vandalism against the pipeline in 2016 and 2017, when it was being built. Earlier, Jessica Resnicek had been sentenced to 8 years in prison for attacking the pipeline. And there was a preview story about the Octagon Art Festival in Ames, which took place last Sunday for the 51st time. The event features artists in a wide variety of mediums, from mixed media and wood to fiber and glass. The event on Main Street featured 85 artists from 6 states, along with free entertainment that included musical and dance performances, food trucks, and a kids' craft area. The Octagon was founded in 1966. It's a nonprofit community arts group at 427 Douglas Avenue in Ames. It features art exhibits, art classes, and a gift shop. Sunday's paper reported that state health officials were working with the Ames Community School District to get the high school swimming pool open again after it had been shut down a week earlier. But there was no clear answer as to why paperwork was never filed that could have prevented its closure in the first place. The president of Story Construction, which served as construction manager for the new high school, said there were, in his words, a lot of parties who could have filed the paperwork, and nobody did. The Iowa Department of Public Health forced the Ames District to close the pool September 14th, 3 weeks after the new school opened, and after Ames had already hosted two girls' swim meets. The health department said it had never received a construction permit, had not reviewed engineering plans, and that the pool had not been inspected or registered with the state. Since the pool's closure, the school district says the health department has now received the necessary documents. The Trib also had word about the Salvation Army's new bus that has been transformed into a mobile social service center designed to reach people in need in four central Iowa counties. The bus is stocked with food, personal items, and more, and it will visit Story, Polk, Dallas, and Warren counties on alternating Mondays starting October 3rd. There was also a story that the Ames History Museum will have a new exhibit that will focus on the contributions of local women. It will be called the Luminary Women Initiative, and it will help raise money for a major renovation and expansion of the museum into the Pantorium Building on Douglas Avenue in downtown Ames. That expansion will add nearly five times the exhibit space, as well as a conference space available for rent and rooms for exhibit design and storage. And the Trib reported on the football game last Saturday between Iowa State University and Baylor University at Jack Trice Stadium. Baylor won 31-24. Tuesday's paper reported that a jury in Washington, D.C. had found Doug Jensen, the Iowa construction worker accused of five felonies and two misdemeanors in connection with the invasion of the U.S. Capitol in January 2021, guilty on all counts, ranging from civil disorder to obstruction. He will be sentenced December 16th. Jensen did not testify at the trial, and his lawyers did not call any witnesses. The paper also had word that Iowa could be in for a difficult flu season this year. Health officials said this year's strain of flu could be severe. Experts said it's important for state residents to get their flu shots soon. There was also a report that Iowa has received more than $10 billion from the federal government through a pair of pandemic relief packages. And while much of that money went directly to state agencies for targeted purposes, Governor Kim Reynolds has single-handedly had control of nearly $3 billion of it. No other Iowa governor has ever had such monetary power. She has used that money on such things as broadband expansion, affordable housing development, and nonprofit building projects. She's also used it to cut businesses' employment taxes to the lowest possible level. At the same time, the state was reducing Iowans' jobless benefits. And there was a report about Sunday's Octagon Art Festival on Main Street in Ames. More people were said to have attended that festival this year than in past years, with some estimates saying there were 10,000 or more in attendance. Wednesday's Trib reported that lawyers for Governor Reynolds say that the reversal of both Roe v. Wade by the U.S. Supreme Court and the Iowa Supreme Court's reversal of a 2018 decision enshrining abortion as a fundamental right in Iowa proves that neither the Iowa nor U.S. Constitution ever protected a fundamental right to abortion. Therefore, the lawyers argue, Iowa's fetal heartbeat law was not unconstitutional when it was enacted in 2018. Lawyers for Planned Parenthood, Iowa's largest abortion provider, have argued there is no basis for reviving the fetal heartbeat law after it's been struck down by courts. A court hearing on all this is set for October 28th. Abortions in Iowa are legal up to 20 weeks of pregnancy. The Trib also had word about a project designed to figure out whether American farmers can make money turning prairies and manure into renewable fuel. It's part of a five-year, $80 million federal grant. The project will mix harvested cover crops and conservation grassland with cattle manure into a digester to make renewable natural gas that will go into a pipeline that feeds homes and businesses or be compressed to power trucks and other vehicles. And there were front-page pictures of Monday's Ames High School homecoming parade on Main Street. The homecoming football game is tonight against Council Bluffs. Yesterday's Trib reported that the city of Ames has closed down a section of sidewalk on Main Street because of structural concerns at the former Corner Pocket Building. The sidewalk and parking spaces in front of 125 Main will be closed for several weeks. The building was constructed in 1892 and is the former location of the Corner Pocket Pool Hall. It's on the north side of Main between the Great Plains Sauce and Dough Company and the Oak Lane Candle Company. Corner Pocket was owned by Scott Griffin, whose daughter now owns it. It's been closed since 2019, when Griffin was charged with failing to pay employment taxes. In 2020, he was sentenced to 4 months in prison. There was also word that the Ames City Council had taken a step toward naming the municipal airport after Black Aviator pioneer and former Ames resident James Herman Banning. The council will vote on a future meeting whether to rename the airport. The council's directive this week suggested to be called the James Herman Banning Ames Municipal Airport. But Mayor John Hala pointed out that those not familiar with Banning might think Ames is part of his name. He suggested a better option might be to name it the Ames Municipal James Herman Banning Airport. Guidance from the Federal Aviation Administration said Ames should remain in the name so people know where the airport is. Councilmember Tim Garten said he was against the idea of naming the airport after Banning. He said at least three other people deserved consideration, all with connections to Ames and to aviation. They are Netta Snook Southern, Hartley Westbrook, and Frederick Douglas Patterson. I am Dennis Hart, and that is your summary of the week's news from the Ames Tribune. Thank you so much for listening. Now don't even think about touching that dial, because there's plenty more good listening still ahead on Local Talk and on KHOI throughout the day and evening. As for me, I'm taking this first weekend of October off, but planning to pay a return visit to Local Talk on Monday morning at 7, when I'll have news from all around Iowa. Until we meet again, let's both plan to have a safe, happy, and healthy weekend.
Thank you, Dennis Hart, with your week in the news, and yes, have a safe, healthy, and happy week. It's about 14 minutes after the hour, and you're listening to KHOI Community Radio on 89.1 FM. I'm Mike Metz, sitting in for Pat Schlierbaum today, and with me is station manager Mike Murphy. Let's welcome Anna McCracken and her guests, authors John T. Price and Thomas Montgomery Fate. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
We're doing well here. Like I indicated early, gosh, this is the last day of September. October is tomorrow and Oktoberfest. But you have a festival coming up here, Anna. Tell us about it.
So tomorrow night, we're going to celebrate the Ames Writers Collective's first anniversary. And it's called Music and Conversation Between Friends. Tomorrow night from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Goldfinch Room at Stevens Auditorium. You can find out more about it at ameswriterscollective.org. And I'd like to introduce two of my guests that are going to be there tomorrow, which are, like you said, Tom Montgomery Fate and John T. Price. They're both authors, and they're going to kick off our event before Deb Marquardt and the Bone People play in the second half.
Good morning to you both, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start out with Tom. How did you get involved in this process here, this program for tomorrow?
Good question. I think John and I both happened to have books out recently, and John lives in Iowa, and I was born and raised in Iowa, and I think both of our books address our childhood and the impact of Iowa on us. And John and Anna came up with this program, and I think they knew Deb Marquardt, and John and Deborah Marquardt and I all have been long friends through a variety of networks, so I kind of just lucked out, I think, being included.
So it sounds like John was actually the instigator to get you involved through Anna, is that right?
Maybe. I'm not sure, honestly.
Yes, I confess. Yes, I did. You know,
aren't there laws about dragging somebody from another state across to state lines or something?
Well, Tom can live wherever he wants to, but he's always going to be in Iowa, and you can't take that out of the boy. So, but when Anna talked to me about this at a reading earlier in the summer about this possibility, I immediately thought of Tom because we're both from Iowa, but we both have very strong central Iowa roots. I grew up in Fort Dodge. Tom was born in Ames and spent his childhood here. So this area of the state, we write a lot about Iowa, but this area of the state is home for us and very, very important in our work.
Let me ask you first, John, what instilled you to become a writer? What was that little enzymatic reaction or that little seed that started you on the path of becoming an author?
Well, I think it began with a family that appreciated books and literature. I mean, I grew up with books all around me, you know, kids' books. We went to the library a lot. So I didn't really, in high school, think of myself as a writer or even consider that as a possibility. It wasn't until I went to college at the University of Iowa and, there were some great teachers there. I was in the sciences. I was a pre-med student. But I started to take these classes, and those teachers helped me awaken, not just to whatever possible talent I might have, but just to the power of writing in general as a kind of healing force. So that's also one of the main insights I had in college, that medical science, which I was studying, is not the only healing force. Literature and writing can be too.
Agree with you on that. Along with, I know Anna and I visited briefly Tuesday, that's part of what I think of as kind of that three-legged stool at writing, getting outdoors, and just some inner reflection are all part of mental health, a great way to help your mental health.
Absolutely.
And Tom, what about you? What's your background as far as how you got involved in writing and authoring?
Like John, I also had parents and brothers who liked to read, and so passed a lot of books around, spent a lot of time talking about books. My parents always loved to read the newspaper as well, and so, grew up with that. I do remember one particular experience, though, in seventh grade, my English teacher, Miss Hermans, asked all of us, this is quite odd at the time, over the weekend, to go outside somewhere and write maybe 300 or 400 word description of what we saw of the natural world. And so I walked in kind of into an Iowa snowstorm, and it was like tromping through the corn with my dog. And for some reason, I just loved writing about that. And then when we brought that little paragraph back, she had us record it on a cassette recorder. We had to listen to ourselves reading it. And that was really the first time I thought about languages, you know, that the writer interprets their own language orally. And there's some connection there that I just thought, this could impact a reader emotionally. And like, there's power there. And so I do remember that one incident. But I've had wonderful, wonderful teachers growing up. And I grew up in Ames, but my secondary school was in Maquoketa, Iowa, and I just had wonderful teachers in high school and also at the university.
So I assume that living in Maquoketa, you would have probably found solace in some of the caves there, got away from things, and you could write about your experiences. you talk about the snowstorm, and I told Anna that I write down things, observations, and that, but then I end up throwing things in a box or something. There's no rhyme or reason to. I guess when I retire sometime, I'll sit down and try to sort things out. But I could imagine if I was in that snowstorm, I'd probably just write something like, yeah, I was encountered a polar bear in a blizzard, but his eyes were closed, kind of a thing. So for 350 words, you must have been very descriptive.
Yeah. Yeah, she gave us some instructions. We had to leave polar bears out. And seals and all the other typical Iowa animals we see in the winter.
Well, this presentation that you're going to be giving tomorrow evening, I called it a keynote conversation, I think, Tuesday. And can you describe a little bit about what listeners, folks that are being in attendance, what they can expect?
Oh, go ahead, Anna. Sorry.
No, you can go.
No, I was just going to say, I think Tom and I are going to share a little bit from our new books, and followed by a conversation. We're not sure where that's going to go, and I like that about conversations among writers. So, but we've been longtime friends, so we're going to talk a little bit about, I think, writing and life and, that. Tom, do you have any, are you going to spring us anything on me, like polar bears or anything during the...
I do want to talk about the cougars in the cornfield, though.
Okay. Absolutely. I'll talk about cougars, wild peacock attacks, anything you want.
I've read about it all. Yeah. No, like John, I'm also just looking forward to the conversation. We've been friends for a long time, and a number of the themes in our books intersect at times, and so I think it'll just be a good conversation.
Well, this kind of sounds like a conversation between two friends that are just going to sit there and share reminiscences and that kind of thing. It sounds like a great time. Where are you going to hold this?
We're going to be at the Goldfish Room at Stevens Auditorium from 6 to 9 p.m. tomorrow evening.
Very good.
That's here in Ames on Lincoln Way.
Yeah. And correct me if I'm wrong, but aren't some of your books available, for example, at Dog-Eared Books?
Yes, the Dog-Eared Books will have copies available for people to purchase, and if they run out, then they'll place them on order for everyone and get them signed.
Great. So is there anything, Tom, is there anything that you'd like to say as far as being kind of a transplanted Iowan? Or you've got some pretty national credentials as far as being on another public on public radio as opposed to community radio, which you are now a part of. You share that a little
bit? I like all radio. It all has equal weight for me. Transplant, in the book I write about being out of Iowa, that in that I'm both from there and away from there. And John and I have talked about this a lot, about the idea of home is kind of being not a particular place, but a sense of belonging, you know, kind of like where your sense of being and your vast longings kind of reconcile and you feel like that's the place you should be. So, I don't have, other than transplant, I don't feel like a transplant. I still feel at home whenever I come to Iowa.
That's great. Yeah, I just want to interject that I'm originally from Wisconsin, and every time I go back, I go like I've never really left, and I long for being there. But I've found a lot of great, relaxing, very interesting places here in Iowa. So I have two homes. I have a summer home and a winter home, and I get them mixed up. So,
John, I think you're going to say something.
I was just going to add on to what Tom was saying, and we both grew up here. Tom lives in Illinois, and I've never left the state, even though I teach in Omaha, Nebraska, and have for 25 years at the University of Nebraska in Omaha. So sixth generation living here in Iowa. But like Tom, and we've talked a lot about this, I think even when you've lived in a state for a long time, there's always new things to discover about it, and that's sort of what my work has been a lot about, you know, living in a place that's very familiar to me and deep connection, but discovering new things, particularly in the natural world. And for me, it's been the natural history of the prairies, which I didn't really understand and appreciate growing up. It wasn't until later that I understood and discovered that, you know, that beautiful history here in our state. So
yeah, and coming
yeah,
from
always an active discovery.
In my situation, coming from a state with a lot of lakes and trees, when I got out here, I couldn't understand what happened to all the trees. I've become somewhat enamored with the prairies. In fact, my wife and I have converted some commodity cropland to try to restore some of that prairie, and have really really gotten a feel for what the state was really like. I guess like you you two have done, I've taken that, what you have longed for or witnessed, I can identify with now that I've appreciated what's really around us. It's kind of like you try to discover and then take advantage of what you find wherever you're at. Really appreciate that the two of you have been able to put that down in words and share that with others.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
So I know we've got a follow-up after the two of you get together, and I'd be remiss if we didn't say a little bit something about Deb Marquardt and the Bone People. They will be providing some jazz poetry music in live performance. And they'll also be doing some storytelling through their method. But we've got just a minute or two, and I was wondering if there's anything. I'll give you each a minute, kind of a wrap up. How is there going to be some interaction between you and those folks that are participating, being there during the evening? Are you going to allow that, or how are you going to present this to the audience?
So we'll start at around 6:30 with the authors. We'll have a break, and you're changing my programming by suggesting that they all interact with one another.
But, sorry.
but after the break, then Jeff and the Bone People will come out and sing and tell stories. So, you know, it's kind of exciting. Deb's been back in the studio recording with her band. And it's kind of like, you know, the Rolling Stones getting the band back together. Yeah. So this is really exciting. You know, I know we've got a lot of competition going on here in Ames for events this weekend, but this is the best event to be at. Yeah. And if you want to find out information about it, you can find it at AmesWritersCollective.org.
And Anna, I have to make a correction for you. It's not the Rolling Stones, it's the Rolling Bones. So with that... With that, in closing, Tom or John, do you have any last minute things to entice our listeners?
Well, I think that something that a lot of people don't realize is that John and I are going to do a short interpretive dance while Deb and the Bone People play. Just kidding.
Are you supposed to surprise, Tom?
That alone is worth seeing. So I urge all of our listeners to get down there and watch Tom as he does interpretive clogging dance, I think.
No, John is going to help, though.
Okay. Well, really appreciate really appreciate the opportunity to be visiting with the two of you. Best of luck. This sounds like it's going to be a really fun time, a kind of a reminiscent sharing, that kind of thing, with award-winning authors and Tom Montgomery Fate and John T. Price and Anna McCracken. Thank you for joining
us. Deb Marquardt and the Bone People.
Oh, yes. And Deb Marquardt and the Rolling Bone People.
We're not going to tell her that.
No, okay. But this sounds like a fun time. And so, Anna, just one more time, review the when and where.
It's tomorrow evening, 6 to 9 p.m. at the Goldfinch Room at Stevens Auditorium. And information can be found at AmesWritersCollective.org.
And we'll have that link in our program this afternoon. So,
thank you.
All right. Thanks, gentlemen. Thank you, Anna.
Thank you.
Good
luck. See you guys tomorrow.
All righty.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go downtown.
And we're going downtown to visit with Susan Guyast this morning. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Yeah. And, you know, the weather looks like it's going to be just primo for tomorrow's events. And I would assume you're going to try to reprise that broken record that you seem to keep repeating this week and play it one more time.
Well, we are just one day away from the return of the City of Ames Eco Fair. It is going to be held from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Saturday, October 1st in the West parking lot of City Hall. It'll be the first time that we've attempted to hold this event outdoors, and we've changed the season. We're into the fall. We think that that might attract people who are interested in sustainability, perhaps energy conservation, composting, rain barrels. Just a lot of ideas are going to be out there. We like the idea of having an outdoor event held so closely, just adjacent to Farmers Market. Mm-hmm. And we hope we get some cross traffic downtown. And it gives you an opportunity to take a look at the site of the new downtown plaza, which mm-hmm. will be just east of City Hall. There's not much activity right now. It's just the parking lot has been cleared, and we're going to be moving forward on that project this fall. Really a lovely amenity to offer downtown with an ice skating ribbon, some water features for fun play in the summer, a green space for people to relax in, but just another sign of progress. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things happening in Ames right now, and sometimes if you just stay into the patterns that you've always been in, you don't see things that are happening in other parts of the community. So come down to City Hall on Saturday, take a look around downtown if this isn't part of your regular routine, and enjoy some sustainability programming.
Yeah, it sounds like a great thing, an opportunity once that east parking lot area is completed for a place to relax and reflect and hopefully enjoy part of the downtown community.
Yeah, I like to see hard surface being replaced by something a little bit softer and more natural. And it's not that I don't believe parking isn't important. It is important. And in fact, I think we'll end up with a much better situation of diagonal parking right in front of City Hall with those 10-minute free spaces. If you just need to run in and do your quick business at City Hall, if you need a little bit of extra time, the meters are there. So you, just like they were there in the plaza space, meter parking will be available. There'll be at least a dozen, 15 to 20 of those diagonal parking spaces right in front of City Hall. You won't even have to cross the street.
Yeah, there you go. So, all right. Susan, anything else before we introduce your guest this morning?
Well, I just think a lot of things are happening in the next week or two in the city of Ames. And one of the reasons that I have Eloise Falstrom with me today, who is a planner in our planning and housing department, is because one of those things happening in the next 2 weeks is a really exciting meeting that she has been shepherding, and I just wanted her to talk a little bit about that.
Good morning, Eloise. Welcome to Local Talk. Let's see, we're not hearing the sound. Susan?
I'm not hearing Eloise either.
Okay.
But I can tell you.
Can you hear me?
Here we go.
Yes.
Oh, okay. I'm so happy to be a part of your conversation this morning. And we want to invite people to a neighborhood information meeting that we're having next Thursday, October 6th, 6:30 p.m. It will be held at the Ames Public Library, 515 Douglas Avenue in the Danfoss Room. And you're probably wondering, well, what's this neighborhood meeting about? We received earlier this year a grant from the state Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs, and it was a grant to complete what we call an intensive level survey of properties in two subdivisions. It's a historic survey, and it was, when you think of surveys, you think of engineers measuring and so forth. It's not that kind of a thing. It's looking at the history of the neighborhoods, the architecture of the properties, and the people doing the survey stay on public property. They don't go on private property to investigate. So it's strictly from the street. But in doing this, we found some really interesting things out about the growth of Ames and the growth of this neighborhood and about the architecture and about the people who live there. It's been very interesting and fun to learn these things.
So we did
invite everyone.
Okay, so did some of the residents at the time volunteer to provide information for, say, the structure they were involved with, associated with, or how did you go about that interchange?
So first of all, let me explain the study area where it's located. It's located just to the east of Brookside Park. So it's that area that's bounded by the railroad tracks on the east and Iowa Creek on the west, and it extends north of 6th Street all the way up to 13th Street.
Okay.
So this is a part of the city that was developed. The first plat was platted in 1910, and then just to the north, the plat that's known as Ridgewood was platted in 19. So it was platted many years ago. The development of the homes was not all at one time. It was incremental over time because of some of the things happening nationally and so forth. So what's interesting is to learn about the people that lived in this community and the houses. And, of course, the people who initially lived there are no longer with us. So you're researching a lot of historical documents to try to understand some of that information.
It sounds to me like this area, at least you had two one natural border and then one, of course, by the railroad. So there must have been something that attracted the folks to building in that area. I would assume it would have been the Iowa Creek Valley more than anything. Is that what you were finding?
What's really unique about this area and thing that the developers found unique was that it had a lot of trees on the land.
Sure.
And there was a lot of topography. So there was, some people maybe would have seen that as a constraint to make it harder to develop, but they saw it as an opportunity to work with the land. And so if you're looking at a map, you'll see that the streets in this area are curvilinear. They're not just the normal grid that you see in Old Town. And the reason they're curvilinear is because there were forces in planning that were promoting curvilinear. But beyond that, they were working with the topography and layout of the land to reflect the character of the place with the establishment of the homes. And so there's many trees still in this neighborhood that predate the development. They worked with the trees, they worked with the topography, and they valued the ability to be next to the creek. And they were actually, they set aside part of their property for Brookside Park.
Mm-hmm.
So that was unique too, to have, a development that recognized the value of public open space and have it adjacent to the development.
I know a few folks, a few residents in that area, and I believe some of them have indicated that on the east slope, it was more a prairie savanna, if I'm not mistaken, and then the riverine, the riparian area that is now Brookside Park, it just seemed like a natural for them to set that aside as a amenity that was positive for the folks that lived there.
Absolutely. They marketed it as having every lot being a park. But along with that, its proximity to what was Iowa State College at the time was very significant.
Mm-hmm.
The developers built a footbridge across Iowa Creek to give direct pedestrian access to the college. And they envisioned the extension of 6th Street. And it's funny to think about because we don't rethink about that some of the streets that we have that interconnect now did not connect. As a matter of fact, many of the streets weren't even paved when this was first being platted. The whole idea of paving streets was just starting to become reality. And so there was no extension of 13th Street to the university. There was no extension of 6th Street. The only connection to the university was Lincoln Way, and then, of course, the Dinky, the interurban. But so having a direct pedestrian pathway, people walked That was the mode of transportation for most people, and the car was starting to make its heyday in middle-class America, and that's reflected in the neighborhood, too, because many garages were built at the time the homes were built.
Mm.
But just the connection with the university was really, really strong.
And I notice in that area there are, it seemed like, more alleyways between the residences. That probably had something to do with the way they designed their garages and ports for their vehicles. And you mentioned the Dinky, the Interurban Railroad. The hub on the campus there near the library was, I believe, one of the stations, one of the stops that the students could get on and off to get to downtown Ames. Whereabouts in relation to this area did the rail pass? Was it near 6th Street or south of it?
So the Dinky went, I believe, along Lincoln Way, more or less.
Okay.
So it was south of this neighborhood. It was more just a connection to the university, to downtown, to make both of those entities accessible, for more easily accessible for people. But people in this neighborhood probably walked to campus.
Mm-hmm.
To drive would have been a little bit convoluted because
sure.
the street did not go through.
Sure.
The developers, however, had envisioned having Sixth Street continue to the campus and had worked to have documents in place to enable that to happen. But it was much delayed, it was not part of the original development and many, many years before that connection happened, because it was an agreement between the university, the college, and Story County.
All right.
You know, dealing with crossing the creek.
Sure.
There was the railroad, so forth and so on.
All right.
Lots of ops.
Eloise, one more time. It's again, it's Thursday, October 6th at the Ames Public Library in the Danfoss Room, and meetings to discuss this area. Appreciate you coming on this morning, and thank you. That was Eloise Sandstrom, planner with Ames Planning and Housing Development. And we're going to listen to an interview that Pat Schlierbaum had with Dallas County conservation naturalist Mike Havlick about a hawk watch coming up.
Welcome to Local Talk, Mike Havlick.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
Mike Havlick with the Dallas County Conservation Board.
Yes.
Mike, we met a number of years ago going up to Effigy Mounds for a hawk watch, and boy, all those good vibes have been transferred to the High Trestle hawk watch that's coming up.
Yes, it's next Saturday the 8th from 10 till 4. And no, it's been a long tradition. I guess I didn't even know what I was getting myself into those first years I went up there. But it is, boy, it gets in your blood, and it is something that I look forward to every single year.
So the raptors are migrating this time of year. So walk us through what constitutes a good hawk watch forecast, if you will.
Well, I didn't bring my crystal ball today, but I can tell you there's certain ingredients that help kind of cook up a good one. Having an impending storm coming either that later afternoon or the next day, raptors, contrary to what we might think is they're just super tough and super extreme, they want to conserve as much energy as they can. So if there's a good wind coming out of the north, it will push a bunch of them down. And that's tonight, you know, when I'm paying attention to the weather, I have to for my work because I'm working with people outside every day. But when I see that recipe that we've got a little cold front pushing from the north, that always gets me excited. That being said, we've had days where the wind's blowing out of the south and stuff's still moving. So there is there's no hard and fast formula, but there's certainly conditions that make it more likely to see stuff.
And you would consider this an optimal time on the calendar for raptor migration?
Yeah, the theory is that it's the changing day length. The day lengths are getting shorter, and so, you know, we could say, oh, there's not food available. Well, it's the day length. For a lot of these birds, are the full-on migrants that are going like to South America, the sunlight tells them that this is the time to go. But the partial migrants, the ones that might skip a couple of states or maybe go to, you know, hang out in the southern part of the United States, they're kind of at their own whim. So, yeah, incomplete migrants versus complete migrants. It's usually photo period. But, no, I like it. The weather's changing. You got fall colors. And there's just, you know, I think we all know there's that day length starts changing and there's something intuitive in us that says it's time for a changing season. And some people are leaf peepers and like to watch the fall colors. And I think, you know, some people are monarch watchers and it's fun to tag them this time of year. And then there are people who say, I want to witness this phenomena, the raptor migration.
Help us with some raptor identification. I know you've got a very long history of workshops on how to identify raptors. But say we've got a dark speck in the sky, and what goes through Mike Havlick's mind as you're watching these birds come down the flyway?
So, in fact, thanks for asking. I have this Saturday from 9 till 10 at Forest Park Museum in Perry, I have a Hawk ID program that I'll be offering there using the low technology of overhead projector, and I will be drawing the images up there, and you'll get to have your own raptor identification sheet in your own words and with your own drawing that I'll be guiding you through. But when I do that program, I usually say 3-2-ID. And the idea is to get three distinct field marks that would tell something apart. So usually the first thing you look at is the wing shape. There is long rounded wings and long tail. There's short rounded wings and a long tail. And then there's long pointed wings and a long tail. So it's usually the shape of the wing. And then how the bird is moving. Is it gliding? Does it have to do a flap, flap, flap glide, flap, flap, flap glide? Or is it constantly, you know, beating its wings? That kind of starts narrowing things down into general categories. So if I got somebody who's soaring, that's usually something we consider a bootio, long rounded wings that they can sail on that wind. If I've got short rounder wings, I'm not getting the same lift as somebody with long rounder wings. So that's usually something we call an occipiter, which would be a sharp-shinned hawk or a Cooper's hawk or a goshawk. I've been seeing goshawks here last couple of days. And then the long, thin wings, long pointed wings are the falcons, and they really are struggling for lift. So they're moving their wings pretty regularly. So that's kind of the beginning. And then there's some specific field marks. And sometimes they're so far away, you're just like, ah, it's probably a bootio. And we mark it down as such. We don't say, we're not counting it. We just say, bootio species, one. Yeah.
And the bootio includes the red-tailed hawk.
Red-tailed hawk, broadwings. We should be seeing broadwings right now. They move through in large numbers together. So, but the red-tail is the one we think of as the most basic one that we see here year-round. They're the ones you see going to grandma's house at Thanksgiving. They're the ones you see in the summertime raising babies. They're what we call a common Iowa raptor. Broadwings do well along our rivers with big undisturbed forests, but they come down from Canada, Minnesota, and they come in large numbers. I know we've had days where they're screaming, you know, 100, 200 at a time that we could see 3,000 in a three-hour period.
Quite often, the broadwings as a bootio not being singular. It'll be in groups, it sounds like.
Yep, and all those kettles, they move together in a big bunch, and by the time they hit, like, the southern part of the United States, there's tens of thousands.
Yeah. Let's help us with these red-tailed hawks. I remember growing up, and I tried to do the different colors. You know, you look for a red tail. Well, lo and behold, I learned later in life that they don't acquire the red tail until their second year. So there's a lot of a lot of red-tailed hawks out there without a red tail because they're the young of the year. So color, and there's a term, morphs, or morph, the morphology, the color morphs. So you're driving down the gravel road, and you see a raptor on a light pole, and what's the first thing that comes to mind when you are thinking, let's identify this bird?
Just where it's sitting. Sometimes you can tell, like red tails usually don't like to sit high and sit on a like a telephone pole. I've seen them sit on a wire, but if you're seeing something that's sitting on a wire, a lot of times that's going to be somebody with smaller feet, like a kestrel or a Cooper's hawk, even though they're not really open country birds. If they're out in open country, that's where they're going to sit. So I'm going to kind of watch where they're sitting. And then I look and see, like, what's the proportion of their body to their tail? Because, like I said, those short rounded wings with long tails, their tail is exceptionally long. So you start looking and thinking that's going to be a sharpshin or a Cooper's hawk. And then where they're sitting, too, I know merlins, like kestrels like to sit up high, but merlins, which is a migrant that we should be seeing any day. I haven't seen any yet this year, but they like to sit low. So if you see someone sitting low on a perch, then you can start thinking about those merlins. But then I just start looking for, you know, there's some simple slam dunk field marks. Like when I'm looking for red tail, you're right, they don't all have a red tail, but most red tails have a V on their shoulders. We call that the scapular V, and that's usually the first field mark. But it's always fun to come up on something and go, something not right. And so trying to trust your gut when you're looking at something, that's a big bird, but its tail is not right for a red tail, and its wings aren't right for a red tail. It's got some different field marks, and so then it always helps when they flush to give you a little, a little more clues. But I can tell you, I mean, when I first started, I couldn't tell you what 75% of them were, because they fly into the sun.
Yeah.
They get a good angle.
Oh, sure.
Even now, I'll bet I don't know what 25% of them are. When you're just driving and seeing alongside the road, but there's always excitement, and this is something I always talk about in my beginning birders classes, because we as humans, I think we really, why do we go to ball games? Because we want to see something rare, something exceptional. Why are we turning into baseball to watch Pujols? It's like, I didn't really care until his numbers are getting up to a round number, but that's, pull up and you see a raptor, you're like, oh, is this going to be something rare? Is this going to be a merlin? Is this going to be a red shoulder? Is this going to be a peregrine? And your brain likes to go there just to like, oh, I get to tell somebody this on something rare. But so just trying to get comfortable knowing just like, okay, I see the scapular V, that's something. But then that excitement when like, oh, this is something different. That's part of the chase. I think that's the fun part of this, is like, could this be something different?
Somewhere along the way, somebody mentioned a belly band on the red-tailed hawks. And since that time, there's dark Harlan-phased red-tailed hawks.
Yep.
There's the Kreider phases. They're very light-colored. But generally, there is a speckling of a belly band on a lot of the red-tailed hawks too.
Yep,
just as a suggested to kind of watch for that, because they'll be sitting there looking at you, and as you say, they'll usually fly, because they're still very wary of people but as another bootio, we might just end up with this talking about the rough-legged hawks that come in, and when you mention perching low, well. A lot of times on a fence post, because in the Arctic tundra where they come from, there's no tall trees.
And so that rough-legged is interesting. And this is the fun thing about doing hawk watch is, it's fun, it's social, it's fun to ID birds. But we get real data out of this. And one thing that happened, I think, in 2018 to 2019, a fellow naturalist, a friend of ours, Matt Weitrich, it was end of day, something's flying really high, your eyes are fatigued, you need that little floaties in there, you're not sure if you're looking at a hawk or a floaty, and there's this new phenomenon now of people not using binoculars, but using high-end cameras.
Yeah.
And end of the day, and it's probably a red tail, we've seen a million of them, and he uses this camera, and he shoots clear up and then zooms in, and it's a rough-legged. It's a rough legged on October 8th. You know, usually the first one you see is after Thanksgiving. So it's like, holy smokes, here's information that says they're here 6 weeks, 7 weeks earlier than we ever thought. And then afterwards, when we were packing up, we were getting a bite to eat, and a dark phase rough legged went over us. And I think it just blew everyone's mind of understanding, like, these things are here now. That's the other beauty of this, is just not just the prettiness of them and the, you know, the camaraderie and, you know, the phenomena, but learning data, having data that we can say these guys actually show up a lot earlier than we ever thought.
And mention the opportunity for learning at Forest Park coming up, hawk identification. What time? And
it's this Saturday. Is that October 1st? I don't know. My days are around.
Yeah, that's right.
Saturday. It's a Saturday from 9 till 10. I'll have you down out there before the Hawkeyes kick off. If you're a true Hawk fan, you'll stay, but that's a different story. But you'll have a seat. I'll be booming on an overhead projector, and you'll have 19 different raptors that you'll have the three field marks for. And that's something, too, that I think is – I was thinking about this when we talked earlier, and the beauty of just studying nature, and I think studying raptors and studying birds, you know, Leopold always said, we get hooked on this because they're pretty. That's kind of the hook, but I think there's a spectrum. You see something, it's pretty, and then you're curious about it, so you want to learn about it. So you delve in and you gain some knowledge, and with that knowledge then comes understanding. And when you have that understanding, now there's a new appreciation, there's a joy. I mean, I can't tell you how happy I am at Hawkwatch just to see the phenomenon. I mean, that's joy. And then I think the final step of that maybe is an honoring. I mean, migration is no small task. 75% of the raptors that were born this year didn't make it, so you're seeing, you know, the fearsome few that are, and they're on their way to Argentina. You know, they're on their way to Mexico. Yeah. They're going to be running into all these hurricanes. I mean, it is no small feat to witness this phenomenon. Wherever you are on that spectrum, we welcome you on any part of that and would hope to engage you on whatever level you're at.
They're the best of the best, as you are. Mike Havlik, Dallas County Conservation Board, thank you so much for, and let's get out there and learn something October 1st, but come to the High Trestle Hawk Watch October 8th, and I think the hours are
10 to 4.
10 to 4.
That's the other beauty. We're not asking you to get to a 5:30 warbler hike in May. Just look in and have a breakfast and enjoy your coffee on the deck and then roll in at 10 o'clock. Yeah. Things will really get going until then anyway.
Yeah. Okay. See you there. Thank you, Mike.
All right.
Thanks, you so much.
Okay.
See ya.
Thank you, Pat, and thank you, Mike Murphy and Lynn Carey, for the production help today. I am Mike Metz, your host, and we'll see you again on the radio.
Support for KHOI comes from the Ames Community Arts Council, presenting the Ames Artists Studio Tour, Saturday and Sunday, October 1st and 2nd. Artists will open their studios for tours and hands-on demonstrations. Details at amesart.org.
This is KHOI, Story City, Ames, and surrounding area.